It's time once again for Catalog and Cocktails, your honest, no BS, non-salesy conversation about enterprise data and AI with tasty beverages in hand. I'm Tim Gasper, joined by Juan Cicada. Hey, Juan, how are you?
Hello, Tim. Here we are again every week. Glad to be back and super excited to have a very unique guest because this is somebody who you and I, Tim, have been working with for a long time. It's somebody who has such a vast knowledge that has been living in the data space from so many different angles, and also has a lot of kind of like just community experience. I love Patrick McGarry, who is now Federal Chief Data Officer at ServiceNow, but we work together at data.world and has been kind of the big unifies a community around the data space and open data early on. Patrick, such a pleasure to finally have you on the podcast. And by the way, ServiceNow is probably the only time we'll talk about ServiceNow. So.
There you go.
How are you doing, Patrick?
Doing well. I appreciate you having me on. Like you said, it's been a long time coming. It's been fun to watch the growth of Catalog and Cocktails from the early days of data.world. So I even wore my data.world swag for in honor of this this Catalog Cocktail podcast. So
I love it. All right. Well, let's what are we drinking? What are we toasting
for?
Yeah,
throwing toast.
Yeah, I mean, today I figured it was a special occasion, so I'm drinking The Little Book. I'm a simple man. I like whiskey and glass. You put the two together and you have a recipe for success. So
it's a t-shirt right there.
I've never tried Little Book before. What's the story of Little Book?
So if you've had Booker's, this is their like limited release version of Booker's.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, interesting.
Okay. How about you, Tim?
Just side note, you know, Patrick, whenever we did events at data.world, would always bring the most interesting whiskeys. So
that's for sure.
I remember trying that special edition Bunnehabhan that you brought. I was like, wow, you know, yeah, it's good stuff.
Yeah, well, it was fun. The whiskey club, right? Or the whiskey pod that we had with Azel and Mark and all the other, you know, we had quite the collection of whiskey aficionados at data.world. And, you know, we did our whiskey advent calendars that benefited Pets Alive. So. Yeah, it was
fun. Yeah, every once in a while, people ask me about those whiskey advent calendars. They're like, "Are you guys still doing those? Are you still doing those?" Like, no. Like, we were actually a catalog company, not a whiskey advent calendar company. Right. But I am drinking a Scotch and ginger, so nothing too
very classic catalog, a classic cocktail.
Yeah, and what about you, Juan?
I am drinking the Boulevardier, so it's whiskey and. Yeah, so my Campari and which vermouth did I have? I forget what one. Anyways, a sweet vermouth. Good classic. I'm enjoying this.
I should have hired somebody to get me a nice fancy pre-prohibition cocktail to keep up with you guys here.
But look, cheers to the classics then, right? Yeah. Cheers. All right, everybody. Cheers. All right, let's kick it off. Patrick, you recently published a book. We'll learn more about that, but also, and you've been now working so much about with chief data officers yourself too at the federal market, and you're seeing everything that's happening in this space right now more from an organizational challenges. What are those organizational challenges that you're seeing right now the most? Because as we can imagine, tech isn't always the problem, right?
Right. Well, actually it's funny, like I wrote the adaptive organization because of some of the things that I was seeing, but it actually happened almost by accident. When the acquisition happened of data.world, we had that kind of like pencils down period. And I was like, hey, I'm just gonna write a bullet list of all the things that I do to help our customers understand, you know, data modernization or AI or whatever. And it ended up being like a 36 page bullet list of all the things that they usually think about. So I was like, if I add a few connective words, it turns it into a book, right? So. But the things that I actually see, people, you know, often bring me in to have conversations about, oh, I got to figure out how to fix my data transformation failures or my AI implementation disaster. And when you dig into the root cause, it's almost never the technology, like funnily enough, like whatever they've chosen, right? And it was almost always organizational, bad governance structures, unclear roles, misaligned incentives. But like sort of the central thesis here is that, you know, my favorite new tagline, which is intelligence without action is just overhead, right? You can have perfect data, perfect AI models, but if your organization can't sort of absorb and act on that intelligence, you've completely wasted your investment.
So it looks like we've been focusing so much. I like this. Like, intelligence without action is just overhead. So we've been focusing so much on the intelligence part and not the action. And the action is kind of the slack of the organizational challenges. So let's break this down. So what are those organizational challenges? What are those things that are not letting us take action?
Yeah, I mean, there's a number of them depending on sort of what you have. But it's usually a question of ownership and outcomes, right? The biggest thing that people usually lose focus on first is that they do technology for technology's sake. They're sort of overwhelmed with their own magnificence of, look at this tool that I have stood up, and they've lost sight of, what are we doing? Like, you got a hammer, you probably want to hit the nail, but hitting the nail is the point, right? Building the house is the point. And they've lost sight of what are those mission outcomes that they need to be focused on. And they've just sort of gotten wrapped around the axle of, look at this neat technology, this toy that, and that's, you know, that's why so many of these AI pilots fail, is because they built a toy and they have no path to sort of enterprise implementation.
Solution looking for a problem. Yeah. Yeah. And that's interesting. So, yeah, you know, obviously you work a lot in the federal space, and, you know, it sounds like, you know, I hear all the time about these problems in more of the commercial side, where, you know, it's like, oh, we're building a data lake. Why are you building a data lake? Or like, you know, the sort of technology searching for a problem. You know, does that same kind of situation and sort of organizational challenge happen in the federal space as well? It sounds like yes.
Oh, 100%. And especially now, like, I'm sure we've all seen the news and been following along at home at, you know, DOGE and the fork in the road and early retirements. And like, they've just absolutely driven a truck through their workforce. And so that these massive gaps, in addition to what any other organization would be facing in the commercial side around, you know, who owns what and, you know, what are we doing to drive the ball forward and making sure that everybody's aligned and all of those sorts of things. So the federal market kind of got hit with a double whammy for some of these problems.
Mm-hmm. And go ahead, Juan.
No, you go. Continue.
No, I was going to say, and so like ownership and outcomes, obviously that's one thing, tech for tech's sake. What other problems are you kind of highlighting that you think are really pressing?
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's a, I don't know, I'll call it an understanding gap. It's not necessarily a talent gap because you look at culture and talent as a big part of this, which as we're doing these rapid modernizations, and I mean, technology is changing faster than it ever has before. And somebody that has a historically very slow procurement model, like the federal government, is really suffering, because by the time they gather the requirements and put out the RFIs and the RFPs and they do their procurement and they take it through the cycle, like, you know, that can take sometimes a year just for them to say, I have an idea to, I have a thing, before they even get to start implementing it. By then, I mean, how often are we getting new models off the frontier AI tools and things like tech has changed, has passed them by in the time it took them to buy it. You know, thankfully, we're seeing a lot of really interesting things around, you know, the other transactional authorities and some of these faster ways to procure things and some of their experimentation things that we've seen. But point being is, like, we've left the people behind in all of this. Even just trying to get software, we're way behind. But like, we're not helping to bring people forward. And so I think that there's an understanding gap of what even art of the possible is as we start moving. And it's not that they don't have the technical capabilities to absorb the change. It's that they just don't understand the state of the art because they're too busy working on outdated or outmoded platforms, even as they're delivered new.
That's interesting. So how much of this is just the bringing in new blood, new people to kind of challenge the status quo, or is there, because I get these organizational challenges, like, how do we address these right now? Right. Because again, it's not technology.
Yeah. I mean, that's a hard question. And I think every organization is going to solve it slightly different, not to give you a, you know, everybody's different kind of answer, but, you know, I think we're seeing some of that now. And I'll speak primarily to the federal space, because that's where my expertise lies. But I think we're seeing, you know, we are seeing a lot of these dedicated public servants or even some new people from industry that are coming into the federal government to try and change these things. And many of them are surprised by the handcuffs that they're sort of saddled with to try and get those things done. But we are seeing a lot of that new blood. The problem is you need a blend, because there are very specific domain requirements that your long tenured federal employees understand, and that someone who is new will not understand and will run smack dab into that brick wall when they're trying to do their, you know, fast moving stuff. So like, it's gotta be a knowledge share. And I think, you know, there are things that can help, you know, the three of us obviously are very invested in some of these like semantic layer and broad organizational understanding types of problem solutions. And I think that that's only going to help, because it will create that translation layer between, you know, whether it's the AI haves and the have nots, or whether it's the governmental longstanding employees versus folks who don't understand the domain, right? And having that translation layer, I think, is going to be a really important part of this equation.
Interesting. And so, you know, in your book, you define sort of this idea of the adaptive organization. So like, what does that mean? Like the adaptive organization, and how does one become adaptive?
Yeah. I mean, what's in the title, right? And you got to throw out 100 and you choose the one that sounds the best on the cover. Right. But I mean, your point is accurate, I think. And I think, the interesting thing to me has been watching how the C-suite evolves to meet some of these challenges, mm-hmm. right? And so, you know, with the advent of the chief data officer, so it was put in as policy. It was mandated as a part of the Evidence Act several years ago in the federal government, where they said, hey, everybody at this level needs to have a chief data officer, and here are their mandates. And so it was forced upon many of these agencies that didn't realize that they needed this thing. But we've seen this sort of cascade. Now everybody's thinking about, oh, is it a CDAO, or maybe it's just a chief AI officer all by itself? Or, you know, I like to say this has become the EIEIO of C-suite execs, right? But I think the rest of the C-suite hasn't been keeping up as much. And I think to be truly an adaptive organization, you really need to have people from the top that are leading by example, and are actually leaning in and understanding how things are evolving, whether it's the chief data officer who wears like 17 hats and not just tech leader or whatever. They have to be part diplomat and part evangelist and whatever. But I think the rest of the C-suite has some catching up to do in terms of how to be very prescriptive and sort of get ahead of some of these problems.
Yeah. And was that one of the primary goals of kind of writing this book? Thinking about like, hey, how can I provide some guidance to some of these leaders on how they can actually do a better job in this area?
Yeah. I mean, it was primarily actually the title that I started off with was a CDAO field guide. So I was really focused on looking through the lens of the new kid on the C-suite block. But a lot of the lessons that I ended up incorporating could be adapted across CIOs and CTOs and some of these other folks, just because it is such a, you know, one, I stole the term socio-technical problem from you. I don't know if it originated with you or someone else, but it's been one of my favorite things, and people just really seem to get it when I describe it that way. They're like,
Let's dive into these lessons learned. I know in your book you have the catalog framework. So I'd love to kind of dive into like, what are these things that people should take away with?
Yeah, I mean, you look at all of these things together and you realize that it really is all across the C-suite, right? Culture and talent, your leadership across the people side of the organization. Analytics and AI, this is your technical piece. The actual physical technology and architecture, that's IT. You've got alignment, I think was the next one, A, right? I'm spelling this right. But making sure the incentives align, right? And making sure that people are, I saw a thing today about the Museum of Ineffective Measures or something like that. It was talking about how it used to be lines of code, and then it became story points, and then it became, pull requests. And now we have a new one that's like number of tokens generated, right? And so it's like, if you measure the wrong stuff and you incentivize people in the wrong way, you're going to just sit there and spin your wheels, right? And then leadership and governance, operations and delivery, right? So where you're sort of requiring proximity to decision makers, you know, an alignment with existing workflows. Like there's a whole bunch of things that come together when you actually kind of make it go. And then growth and measurement so that you're actually, you understand when you have succeeded, like when do we reach the finish line? Those were sort of the domains that I threw in. And I again, thanks to ChatGPT for helping me come up with a tongue-in-cheek thing that I couldn't take too terribly seriously coming out of a data catalog company. It felt appropriate.
Nice. I like a lot of the tenets that are articulated here because it really helps you think about more broadly the different kind of aspects of performance management, change management, organizational design, but then also the interfacing of technology too. So,
what I really like, actually, I know it's kind of cute the whole the framework, but it's actually pretty complete if you think. I mean, I'm going through this whole right now. So you start off with the people side, right? The whole there's AI. Then you actually need the technology, right? This thing needs to run. The alignments and the leadership, I think they go hand in hand. But also, we were having a discussion the other day about alignment. Is you have horizontal alignment and aligning up, aligning down, and that's such an important thing to be able to go do. And also, understanding the incentives of others is how you're actually going to figure out how to go align. Anyway, the operations is another thing. It's like everybody can just stand up and start talking, but we got to really be tactical and deliver this and write that, right? And it only needs to be, I mean, that's part of your roadmap, but that's your vision, but it's also how we're going to go deliver this. And I think that finally, that growth and measurement aligns also with like, is this an ongoing thing? Is this a project one and done, or is this continuous and stuff? So actually, kudos to this. I'm actually thinking about it right now, like what's missing? Trying to poke holes at it. I don't know. Poke holes at your own framework. Well, what's missing?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the good news here is that most of this is not original thinking. It's just aggregating things that have existed for a long time, right? And Tim, I think you just said something to that effect, which is like a lot of this stuff has come before, right? Change management is not a new concept, right? And like some of these things are not new to the point where like, and I want to give credit, Dean Alamang turned me on to this dude, Deming, who is from like the manufacturing era, looking at quality control in manufacturing and like fixing problems or defects after something has come off the product line is super expensive. But if you catch it earlier in the process and correct it there, or better yet, if you anticipate and correct it before you even build the thing, it's way less expensive. And I think that same, and this is what I applied in the book, which is that same concept applied to like AI outcomes. If you build your governance in from the beginning to protect things as it flows through the pipeline, it's a hell of a lot cheaper than trying to add that governance in.
But how do we deal with? So I think completely this goes back into like it's more preventive, right? But then it's actually, it's fun to not do the preventive things, right? I mean, this is why like going to the gym and eating vegetables, like I'd rather go drink whiskey and have drink beer and burger, right? Instead of going to the gym at that time. So the incentives also like short term. I'll go to the gym tomorrow. Right? I'll do this tomorrow, and then at the end of the day, it's like, well, it's not me. Oh, it's somebody else's problem down the line, right? So again, goes back to the alignment, the incentives. Like, how are you seeing a shift in this, or is this more top down? People are saying, no, we're freaking mandating you to go to the gym and like stuff like that, or and especially in the federal market. Like, how are you seeing this right now? Because I mean, this incentive in the short term versus long term, or short versus medium long term, like that's the problem that we have right now. The incentive.
That's actually a really good point. Like, and making people eat their meat and potatoes before they go to the AI dessert table is certainly a challenge to like sort of interrupt that action. But you know, to sort of extend your metaphor here, when I do go to the gym, I feel a lot more energy and I have those endorphins, and like there are short-term gains. It's just the sort of momentum to get there is sometimes hard. So like, I think some of this is education, right? Just helping people understand that like when you do this short-term governance, and this is my favorite thing, governance doesn't have to be a dirty word, right? It doesn't have to be a put people in a room for some dark incantations for 18 months. Like, when you do governance, it can be lightweight, it can be upfront. And more than that, it offers people clarity. Like, if I'm going to come in, I'm going to work with some data and it has governance baked in, and I understand how can I use this data? where did it come from? And whose throat to choke do I have when something goes wrong? Like, that's clarity, and I can move fast with confidence, right? And so, like, that's that endorphin hit that hits you in the short term. And then the long term benefits, obviously, have been well stated by many other people, not me. So,
well, obviously, with what everybody wants to accomplish with AI now, I feel like maybe there's also some new carrots around kind of the vegetable eating, the governance, and some of the proactive work. Are you seeing that with some of the customers you're working with some of the, you know, thought partners you're working with, that they're looking at this through a new lens, or is it a little bit slow going?
No, you're 100% right. Like, AI has been one of the biggest sort of disruptors just by itself, and it's a double-edged sword, right? Sometimes it's like, if you don't have AI in your pitch or whatever, then it gets ignored because that's where not where the money's going. But I think right now, at least, we're in sort of this opportune window where most people don't have a deep understanding of what AI is. They've just been told to do AI. They don't know why or what for. So if you can tell a really compelling story and you're sort of holding your customers' best interests in heart, and your customers hoping that you are, then I think you can go do some really interesting things, because you have a really big lever to pull when it comes to getting people moving. The problem is, not everyone is quite so altruistic and they're willing to say, you know, look at us, we're doing AI, and well, you're not really. And so now the customer is bogged down in a quagmire. So there are challenges, but in terms of disruption and just shocking people out of the status quo, I think AI as a topic has done a lot of really good things.
And I think now with AI, we would know that this needs to be something that I can trust, and it's auditable. And that's when you realize, oh wait, therefore now all of this governance stuff is a precondition. So it's now part of the work that I need to go do anyways. So that's one thing that I think that we're seeing more and more organizations that they need to go do. And then also is that if you're going to go do this, just do it. You are already going to go do that governance work. Okay, don't half-ass it. Actually do it right, so it can actually compound. So you're not doing it just for this one thing. You're doing it such that it can be reused across different other use cases and other lines of business and so forth. And then you start seeing that incentive over there. It's like, oh, wow, this thing solved for the AI stuff, and it's actually solved for some other use cases. And I think that's the compounding value that we need to start seeing. And I mean, we want all our dollars to stretch, right? We want the 1 + 1 = 2.
Yeah. Well, and now you've also hit on one of the primary human elements that's going to hit you no matter what you're doing or where you are, which is I can't tell you how often I see people who work so hard at not working. They expend all of this effort because they don't want to do by the time they've spent all that effort not working, they could have just done the thing, right? And I think there's a lot of that in governance. They're just used to, like, oh my God, governance is going to be such a bear. I just don't want to tackle it. So I'm going to work really hard at not having to do governance. and they end up working twice as hard.
Hold on, I'm writing that one right now. I'm going to work so hard not to do it. And I end up. That's a good one.
Yeah, it reminds me of, like, no BS right there. Advice that I've heard in the past, which is that, like, choosing not to do something actually is work.
Yeah, especially like if you have to work to make sure other people think you're working and you're not going to do the work. So
another one that I'm wondering, get your opinion here on kind of the status also within the federal space, is the standards. And thinking about all this, like, now we know that semantics and context is so important, and that's kind of driving the DNA of organization. Like, how are you seeing this within the federal market about how standards are coming in, and how much of that is just like, yeah, it's good to have, versus like, no, this is actually starting to become a requirement? I'm trying to understand that spectrum across different industries.
Standards of any kind inside of the US federal government are another one of those double-edged swords. You have to be really careful there. Like, if you can enshrine a standard, and if that standard becomes out of date, you can very quickly find yourself, you know, sort of hoisted by your own petard there, which is like, hey, we've got this great standard and it's going to work now, but it's also becomes rapidly inflexible, as we've seen in the past with certain kinds of, like, document standards that were enshrined, whether it was PDF or doc versus docx, and like all of these transitions to either expand the sort of keyhole aperture or to move from one standard to the next can be quite painful. And so I think it's good to have standards, but it's also challenging to find people who can write the standards in a way that won't be sort of long-term difficult or harmful. It can be helpful, but then, you know, you just have to understand sort of how the machine works. And thankfully, there's lots of sort of think tanks and thought leaders and stuff that are involved in government to try to be those thought leaders and experts that our congressional leadership can lean on. You know, the Data Foundation is one that we worked with a lot that has been really amazing in terms of we've helped to write legislation. You know, some of the big text that's in the Evidence Act or the Financial Data Transparency Act and those things came from the collective of people involved in the Data Foundation. So the good news is there are ways to do this right. It's just got to be real careful when you start enshrining things in legislation.
That's because one thing about standards that I'm interested in is the whole vendor lock-in, because I know people talk about this so much, and I wonder is how much of this is more of just like an insurance that I want to like, I just feel comfortable, or like there, it's a hard requirement because I am going to change and stuff. Right. So I'm just curious about that.
Yeah. I mean, we're back to another one of those human problems, right? Not everyone is terribly altruistic. And not, you know, sometimes people are very self-serving in their goals and aspirations. You know, leave it to humans to screw up a good thing, right? But you know, to the point of sort of proprietary standards and things like that is it certainly happens, right? I mean, even just look at the memo that's been in the news lately, coming out of the senior Department of War leadership saying, you know, you will spend X amount of dollars on Palantir. Like, I think most administrations from either side of the aisle, if something like that had happened, that would have been met with a very large steel mallet immediately. But, you know, we're just in a different sort of ecosystem right now. And some of these things are changing. Some of it is because they want to move rapidly, and some of it, you know, people are trying to do self-serving things. And so, again, that's the danger, right? But I think the good news here is that you have these long tenured public servants who really are like, people always hear the headlines about, you know, civilian leadership and how things are a mess. But the nice thing that I've found about being in DC and being sort of immersed in this culture is when you go and you find the people that are actually doing the work, these people are highly skilled, highly conscientious employees of the federal government that care deeply about the mission and the outcomes. And the good news is those people are very invested in things like open standards and ensuring that they don't paint themselves into a corner, and they've been burned in the past and they know what happens. So like, I think that there's, you know, it's like anything, there's going to be a tug of war, but I think we have the right people doing some of these things to protect us against it.
That's what I appreciate. Like when I work with folks like in healthcare also and federal government stuff, it's like, if people have been there for a long time, it's like they're truly passionate about this space. And for them, it's like, yeah, I mean, it's a job, but there is a reason that they really believe in what they're doing and what needs to be done. And they're up for the fight all the time. And I look at it and I'm like, I have so much respect, because I'm like, I'd probably flip a table. I mean, so quickly they can do this.
Yeah. I mean, it's so hard to be where they are. They're certainly not doing it for the money.
They're not doing it for the recognition, right?
They're never going to make headlines unless they really screw something up.
If you do get the headlines, it's for the bad things, not for the good things, right?
That's right. So yeah, the motivators truly are like, they're there. Most of them are there for a very, very impressive and, as you said, like, you know, respectable reason. And I have come to have a very deeply seated respect for the people that can stomach the job and do it as well as they do.
So what else? Give us, I like to think about this as like a faith in humanity of like stuff that's happening. from a data perspective and governance and policy perspective, what you're seeing in the federal space, like, I mean, faith in, heading, we're heading the right direction, or should we be scared? I don't know.
No, I mean, I think we're in sort of the, you know, you've seen the hype cycle, right? The trough of disillusionment. Like, I think that's where we are right now. And I think a lot of people have learned some very hard lessons or are sort of in the process of learning them. And the good news is I think we're going to come out the other side of this sort of chrysalis with some people that are incredibly energized about what is possible and what they need to do to get to the sort of desired outcomes. You know, and sort of as evidence of this, I think we're starting to see enough people, you know, was it Rand that had a study that said like 80% of enterprise AI projects are failing to deliver promised value, right? And you've seen, I'm sure, a dozen statistics that say something similar. And I've seen a lot of them that are focused on the human factors again. And I think with all of this pain, I hope will come enlightenment. And you're already starting to see those moments of clarity where, you know, the joint staff inside of the DoD are specifically asking for open graph standards compliance solutions by name. Like they're saying RDF and OWL and Sparkle and all of our favorite terms, right? They're using our million-dollar words like ontology. And like, so you're starting to see people, and even on the Gartner side, right? I think they came out with a report 3 or 4 months ago that was like the ontology or semantic layer is a necessary brick if you want to succeed in the future or something. I forget how they phrased it. They always come out with those wonderful marketing phrases. But I think the pain is leading to good things. And so there's your moment of hope is that, and I'll give you a personal anecdote to tie this to, which is I was in the Navy, as you can see above my head, and our drill instructor had a favorite saying. It says, you gentlemen used to learn a lot faster when we could put our hands on you. So pain is the greatest teacher. And I think we've experienced a lot of pain in the last, you know, 18 months. And I think people genuinely are learning and doing the right things.
Well, that's good. That's good. I can see Juan's feeling of relief now.
Well, I mean, this is the honest, no BS way of seeing it. It's like we've been going through a bunch of stuff. Like everybody gets annoyed around this time. It's like, oh, right. They roll their eyes. And that, I mean, that's one sort of a pain. I mean, just annoyance. And we're getting over that. I mean, we're seeing so much hype around this. And I think just the hype cycle is just very clear, right? And I think we're going to start going up around that stuff. And I think you combine that with the people who've been doing this for a long time, who are doing it because they know it's the right thing to go do, and they're still there, right? That means something. That's always a good kind of combination, and that's why the kind of we come back and I'll get a line, and we're heading the right direction. So I always have faith in humanity, and I'm a rational optimist.
Yeah, and I mean it's interesting too. If you're sort of want to be a student of history, I would challenge you to go back and look at some of the most transformative things in the last century or two, and look at the timelines. Like the timeline that we're on to get to where we are from where AI first hit. Compare that to like the smartphone transition, or you know the internet, or even moving off of phone books. Like whatever you want to like, pick a moment in time. Or several, and look at how much we're compressing that timeline. And I think that gives me more hope than anything. Like we have gone through the hype, we've realized that stuff doesn't work out the way that we want, and now we understand how we got to build it for real. And that's a blink of an eye compared to past versions of this sort of change management problem.
I think what you just said there, I think prompts a good kind of last question here before we go into our sort of final three, which is that, you know, you're right. The pace of change is increasing, and AI is like a great example of that. And AI is really an umbrella. There's all these sub things that are happening within sort of that umbrella of AI, which are emblematic of this. Every 3 months, the game is a little different. And obviously this idea of an adaptive organization definitely orients itself around the idea that it's got to be able to handle that kind of pace of change. You know, what's your biggest advice or observation around like how you keep up with a technology ecosystem landscape that's that every time you think you've got the rules figured out, maybe 3 or 6 months later, you gotta reshuffle the deck again. What's your advice around that?
I mean, I think the biggest advice is start with your organization and make sure that sort of the boundary conditions and the rules are clear to your people, and then empower them to go do real things off the leash. You know, I like, people will often ask me, what do I have to do to make my organization AI ready? You know, heavy italicized quotes, AI ready. And I often tell them that's the wrong question. The question you should be asking is, how do I make my organization ready to be accountable for AI? And I think like that comes part training, it comes part, you know, process and enablement, and you really have to let your people move fast and hopefully at least as fast as the technology is changing. So that would be my take on that.
Yeah. That's a great way of closing this out. That was never thought about that way. I like this. Patrick, thank you so much for this very fantastic conversation. All right, let's go to our final three questions. I mean, you already started off, but I'll expand a little bit more on this. What's your advice about data over life? Who should we invite next, or what topic should we have if you don't have anybody to name? And then what resources do you follow?
Oh, interesting. Okay. So yeah, the advice, I think, start with organizational change, not technology. You know, ownership is a big deal, but it also, like, setting your people off the leash, that's a good one. Mm-hmm. Who should we invite next? There are so many people, and especially inside of the public sector, they just have such a unique perspective. And I really value that. And I think you guys would really get a kick out of like some of these Fed CDOs, especially somebody inside the Department of Defense or Department of War. you know, talking to those folks, I think provides such a different lens on sort of what mission critical means. There's some interesting folks. And another one inside the Fed Civ side, Juan, you just met, Austin Gehrig at SEC, is way out in front, and probably, I think, now the longest tenured chief data officer inside of the federal government. So he's been doing some really cool things. He's been around long enough to have felt some pain and know where the bodies are buried. So that would be certainly
cool. Reach out to him. And then finally, what resources do you follow?
Oh gosh, I don't follow a lot of, like, I have my people that I follow on LinkedIn. I try to get a good smattering across the technological personality and political spectrums, just because I like to try to understand all of that. But, you know, honestly, here I'm going to tell you that I use Claude heavily as a resource filter, generator, notifier, to just, like, I've given it a very, very long, complex prompt of what are the things that I care about, and go find those news and give me a briefing every morning. So I get my emailed 15-minute briefing from Claude every morning about the stuff that I should care about. And it usually does a pretty good job. Between that and, like, Google News or whatever else pops in front of my face, I usually see the things that I am supposed to care about.
That's a good one. All right. Patrick, thank you so much. Cheers. Appreciate this conversation.